rapidly downhill physically. Too many years of too much food and drink, combined with too little exercise, had made her overweight as well as arthritic. When a psychiatrist finally succeeded in getting her to reduce her drinking, it was too late for her to retrieve her mobility, but not too late to recover her control of her interests and pursuits. She was back again, exercising her authority, criticizing, and arguing. It was quite a comeback, and she was in very good form for the last few years of her life, which she lived to the fullest, with all her mental faculties intact right to the end. I had gone to Mount Kisco to visit her for the Labor Day weekend in 1970, and was awakened on September 1st by her maid, who told me she was worried because my mother had not rung for her breakfast. I sensed that she knew something was wrong, so I jumped up and ran in to find Mother in her bed, weirdly inert and already cold. Though I had been expecting her death for some time, it was still a profoundly moving shock when it became a reality. My mother was no longer there to love, to resent, to emulate, to rebel against. It has always mystified me that I am a weeper on other occasions, but not at deaths. It seems almost inhuman to cry at superficial books and movies, or when upset or angry, but not when I'm deeply shaken, as I certainly was not only at my mother's death, but at Phil's and my father's, as well as my sister's, and later at my brother's, and since then, at too many close friends. I think that part of my reaction to my mother's death was that I couldn't believe she was gone. She had led a long and extraordinary life, and left her distinctive mark in many areas, certainly on her children and grandchildren, and even on the two oldest great-grandchildren. I admire and am impressed by her increasingly with the passage of time. My brother, having finally broken up his long-term marriage, was another worry for me in these years. He seemed always to be ill, and had innumerable back and neck operations, and had started taking pain-killing drugs, as well as drinking more heavily. His loneliness was terrible. Later, he too recovered, and led a good life for many years. My son, Steve, was still another concern. He was lonely at home, since Bill, 4 years his senior, had left for college. Steve was a classic member of his generation. His class at St. Albans was the first really to confront drugs in school, and few of us parents knew how to cope with the social revolution that we saw reflected in our own homes. Unfortunately, since our house was the biggest and the least supervised, it became the place where Steve and his friends gathered, and his room became the local pot parlor. I would return home to find the windows all open in an attempt to get the fumes out and cover up the telltale signs of smoking. I begged him to stop, threatening that if caught, he and his friends would find themselves right on the front page of the Post. It had little effect. My social life was escalating. Some of it had to do with new friends I was making within the industry, some with maintaining a life in two cities, Washington and New York. Much of it was work-related, but part I did from sheer enjoyment. There remained an element within me of disbelief that I would be included by people I thought remote and glamorous. I wasn't pursuing either famous or wealthy people, but my son Bill later told me that he remembered thinking on occasion that there were too many famous people around the house. I suppose that I fell somewhere between the way I had grown up and the way my children now live. High fashion was certainly new to me. Betsy Whitney and Babe Paley had suggested that I try Halston as a dressmaker. He had set up his own designing establishment after leaving the hat department at Bergdorf Goodman. I did try him, and our relationship was a great success. For 14 years, until he went out of business, he made my clothes. I felt I looked better than I ever had. Rudy Serkin was one of my good friends at this time. For a weekend each summer, I went to Marlborough, the music festival and school that my parents had helped him start. I remember watching Casals conduct a Schumann symphony, the most exciting thing I'd ever heard. And we attended rehearsals, much the best part of visiting Marlborough. More important to me, even in our short time together each summer, Rudy and I developed a real friendship, which grew over the years. I loved his stories of his youth, his teachers, growing up in the Adolf Busch household, and falling in love with Adolf's daughter Irena when he was only 15, and she was 4. My one weekend every summer at Marlborough was never enough for Rudy. He always lamented the lack of music in my life, shaking his head sadly about the few concerts I attended or records I played, and saying, "How can you live a life without music?" I felt I made up in part for this deficiency by soaking it up so intensely while I was there. I also saw something of Jean Monnet in these years. He had remained a friend from the time Phil and I had first met him in the early 1940s. The thrill for me of being with him never disappeared as long as he lived. He was energetic and interesting, and I can testify to his virility. I especially loved the way he used the English language and his insightful comments on the American political scene. I recall his once telling me, after he had lunched with Bobby Kennedy, that he had been very impressed, saying, "The president had authority, Bobby has strength." I also developed a friendship with Clay Felker. We fell into instant conversational rapport. I had never met anyone like him, and I appreciated his ideas, his obsession with editing, and even his preoccupation with New York City and with New York Magazine, which he had successfully launched. I never got used to Clay's odd estrangement from the human race, but I grew to be and remain very fond of him. He changed my New York life from one of solemn dinner parties to one of great fun, taking me to ethnic restaurants or to the theater. He often came to Washington, and we went to Glen Welby for occasional weekends. On one of these I brought him together with Rupert Murdoch, feeling sure that they would become friends, which they did. But it turned out to be an unfortunate friendship for Clay, since he talked to Rupert freely over that weekend, even about his having badly alienated his own directors on the magazine. Rupert ended up taking over Clay's company. In the spring of 1971, Fritz Beebe came to me with a critical decision to be made. He thought our situation was such that we had to take the company public, as some other bigger companies, Times Mirror and Knight Ridder, for instance, had already done. If we didn't, he felt we had to sell one of our assets, something big, like our television station in Jacksonville. According to Fritz, we were strapped for cash. Phil had handed out stock options fairly freely, and since we were a private company, we were required to buy the stocks back at a valuation determined by Price Waterhouse. By this time, the price of the stock had risen far more than had been foreseen, and we were having to spend cash for these options as people left or retired. I wish I had understood the whole thing better than I did. My learning paths were more in editorial and management, and I still knew little about business and simply took Fritz's word for the problem and assumed we had only two choices, either go public or sell WJXT. I wasn't sure what being a public company entailed, but I knew there would be obligations and disciplines that were not imposed on private companies. I also knew that we would have to be open with information to shareholders. Yet, thinking that it might be good for us to have to run our businesses in a more disciplined and profitable way, I decided that we ought to go public. All my instincts said we should go forward, not back. What I didn't understand, since the day of the takeover had not yet dawned, was that there was a risk we might be taken over by any of these larger companies that had sent out feelers and had remained in a friendly, courting kind of stance. Thank heaven Fritz and his cravath partner George Gillespie did understand this. They created a situation in which we went public with two classes of shares, the A shares, about 1 million, which were all owned by the immediate Graham family, and the B shares, of which there were 10 million, owned by the public, by my brother, and by the profit-sharing fund started for employees. I controlled the majority of A shares, and my 4 children owned the rest. People bought the B shares knowing the company was family-controlled. Warren Buffett, whose company Berkshire Hathaway, bought about 10% of the company's B shares in 1973, later told me he didn't think we really had to go public, but was glad we had. In fact, I was glad we had, too, although I still dislike some of the responsibilities being public entails. The advent of Warren was only one of the positive things that resulted from our going public. It gave us some proper discipline about profit margins, although I worry about the overemphasis at times on the price of the stock. It also gave my children who were not working for the paper a certain amount of flexibility in their own financial management. The date of the stock offering was set for June 15th. In a ceremony on the floor of the American Stock Exchange, I bought the first share for $24.75, and we went public at $26 a share. This important step in the life of the Washington Post Company coincided with some heightened tension with the Nixon administration. As it happened, the June date turned into one of the most dramatic times of my life, but not because we went public. In May of 1971, the Post had had another of those dust-ups with the White House, which got quite shrill over nothing. Tricia Nixon was going to be married to Edward Cox at the White House in June. We had assigned Judith Martin to cover the wedding and the activities preceding it, but almost a month before the wedding, the White House barred Judith, claiming that while covering Julie Nixon's wedding a few years earlier, she had crashed a closed reception at the Plaza Hotel. A spokesman from the White House said, "The First Family, quite frankly, does not feel comfortable with Judith Martin." Despite my success in maintaining some kind of relationship with a few people in the White House, I had never tried with H.R. Haldeman. He made my blood run cold, and I felt sure the feeling was reciprocated. The only time we ever met on an informal basis was one night at a dinner at Joe Alsop's when I sat next to him. I had suggested that he call me if he ever had problems he wanted to talk about, and the one time he did call had to do with Tricia's wedding. Amazingly, someone had prepared a talking paper for him on the points he should go over, which came to light only a few years ago. "As you probably know, there's been considerable discussion back and forth between your people and our people regarding the assignment of Judith Martin to cover the Tricia Nixon wedding. I just wanted you to know that the decision not to provide Judith Martin with credentials for the wedding was in no way a matter of the White House dictating who is to cover events or a punishment of any kind. It's a matter of principle in the same sense as breaking a backgrounder would be. Out of the 350-some reporters who covered Julie Nixon's wedding, all but two followed the ground rules that were laid out. The two that broke the rules were Judith Martin and the other reporter from the Post. I'm sure you'll understand the reasoning behind this, and will agree that under the circumstances, it was the logical action for us to take. I trust that you also will understand the desire of the Nixon family to have the wedding conducted and reported in as wholesome and positive a fashion as possible, since it is completely a personal event, not an official one, and one that means a great deal to all of the family, especially to Tricia." Haldeman phoned me on May 13th. Little seems to have escaped the taping system in the White House, since our extended conversation was taped and a transcript made, which turned up in the Nixon library. It ends, "KG, I wonder if there isn't some way we can just cool it. But if you can think of anything more ridiculous, I'm not even sure Larry Stern knew when he assigned her that, you know, he wasn't here when the first thing, I don't suppose he even thought of it. I just hate to let it get bigger. You know, it doesn't really matter to you or to us, does it?"
H. No, it probably doesn't. Probably doesn't.
KG. I mean,
laughter,
it really doesn't matter. I'm just really thinking out loud to see if there isn't some way we... Usually there's some way of getting both sides off the hook. If we just think about it, unless you just want to leave it stand, I'm just afraid it will be the ridiculous...
Sick.
H.
Well...
KG. So the thing is that they've made an issue, and I don't think they can back down. I'll try to calm our fellows down. That's the best I can try to do, and I may come back to you pounding the table, but I don't honestly care. It's disconcerting to see all this in print, and I'm sure I would have handled the whole thing differently later, but I was in an embarrassing position. I had grave concerns about some of the stiletto party coverage that Style seemed to produce, and knowing how sharp Judith's pen could be, I actually had wondered privately why we had to take on this battle when we were engaged in so many more serious ones. My view was that Judy was an able, even brilliant reporter, but I wasn't sure I'd want her to cover my own daughter's wedding. She had, for instance, already compared Tricia to a vanilla ice cream cone. I didn't mind defending us under most circumstances, but when I had my own doubts about the rightness of our position, the situation grew more ambivalent. In the end, Because the Post was denied credentials to cover the wedding, the paper had the best coverage of the event, since as a form of protest, reporters from other papers all gave Judy their notes, placing at her disposal the finest pool of material available to any reporter in town. The story in the Post appeared on page one with no byline. Much more important was a piece that appeared on the same day, June 13th, about a study of the Vietnam War that the New York Times had found out about and was publishing. Ironically, it was at another wedding, also on that Saturday in June, that I first learned about what came to be known as the Pentagon Papers. Don, Mary, and I had gone down to Glen Welby for the weekend to attend the country wedding of Scotty and Sally Reston's middle son, Jimmy. The wedding was a casual event, and while we were talking to Scotty, he told Don and me that the Times would be publishing, starting the next day, articles about a super-secret history of the decision-making that led us into and through Vietnam, labeled the Pentagon Papers, but more formally titled History of the United States' Decision-Making Process on Vietnam Policy. Unbeknownst to President Johnson, the review had been commissioned by Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara sometime in the middle of 1967, before he left the Pentagon. McNamara later said he had started the study to bequeath to scholars the raw material from which they could re-examine the events of the time. Don and I were unclear what it was the Times had, but we knew that whatever it was important, and that editors and reporters there had been working on it for some time. And, important for us, whatever it was, the New York Times had it exclusively. When we got back to Glen Welby, I called the Post's editors, who immediately started calling around, to no effect. Ben had heard rumors, starting in the early spring, that the Times was working on some kind of blockbuster, but was not able to find out anything about it until he read it in the paper himself. On Sunday morning, I sent to Warrenton for 10 copies of the Times, since there was a sizable group staying at the house over the weekend. Most of us spent much of the day poring over the 6 pages of news stories and articles in the Times that were based on the Pentagon Papers, and in discussing their content and their possible impact. What emerged was that the Pentagon Papers had turned out to be in large part just what McNamara had envisioned, a massive history of the role of the United States in Indochina, which he had intended to be encyclopedic and objective. We learned of a year-and-a-half-long study that had resulted in a 3,000-page narrative history with a 4,000-page appendix of documents, 47 volumes in all, covering American involvement in Indochina from the Second World War to May of 1968, when peace talks on the Vietnam War began in Paris. Later we understood that there had been a bitter fight at the Times over whether or not to publish these so-called top-secret documents, with Scotty and other editors arguing for publication. Scotty believed always that this was a question not merely of legality, but of a higher morality. A vast deception had been perpetrated on the American people, and the paper must publish. The lawyers for the Times, Lord Day and Lord, felt so strongly against publishing that they ultimately refused to handle the case. But the Times went ahead and delivered their bombshell on that Sunday morning in mid-June. Ben Bradley anguished over being scooped. He had worked so hard to build up the paper, not just to be competitive with the Times, but to be taken as seriously, to be out there with them, to be mentioned in the same sentence. Now the Times had landed this big one on us, and Ben, mortified but unbowed, set to work to try to get the papers for the Post. Meanwhile, he swallowed his pride and rewrote the stories that appeared in the Times, crediting the competition with their original publication. The next day, Monday, I was in New York and ended up having dinner with some friends, including Abe Rosenthal, managing editor of the Times. When we had settled down with a pre-dinner glass of wine, I congratulated Abe on the publication of the papers. Soon afterwards, before we had been served dinner, he got word that the government was asking the Times to suspend publication. In fact, Attorney General John Mitchell and Robert Mardian, Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Justice Department's Internal Security Division, had dispatched the message, with the President's approval, that if the Times did not comply, the government would seek an injunction. Abe left immediately, and I used the head waiter's telephone to phone Ben and tell him what was going on. Meanwhile, the Times respectfully declined to cease publication of the series, sending the paper on its path through the courts. By an odd coincidence, when Scotty heard about the government's reaction, he and Sally were dining alone with Bob McNamara, whose wife was in the hospital. Scotty asked McNamara what he thought of the Times' defying the government, and McNamara considered the issues in his usual objective way, and despite his distaste for the early publication of these documents, nevertheless encouraged the Times to go ahead. He even went over with Scotty the message that the Times proposed to send back to the government, responding to Mitchell's message. It was Bob who suggested altering the proposed sentence that the Times would abide by the decisions of the courts to read the highest court. In fact, a compromise was reached by which the Times agreed to abide by the final decision of the court. Scotty later recalled that, had it not been for McNamara's intervention, the Times would have been committed to stop printing by the adverse decision of any court. So, half an hour before its deadline, the Times recovered from a careless and potentially harmful mistake, courtesy of the former Secretary of Defense. Deciding to continue publishing the papers also meant that the Times had to scurry to find new lawyers after 75 years with one firm. They were lucky to get Alexander Bickel, a Yale law professor, and a young lawyer, Floyd Abrams, to work with him as litigator. On Tuesday morning, the Times carried the third part of the series, as well as the story of the government's effort to stop the paper from publishing. Also on Tuesday morning, after an all-night stint by the lawyers, the Times went before Judge Murray Gerfein, who was only in his second day on the bench. Gerfein asked the paper to suspend publishing voluntarily, which the Times refused to do. He then issued a temporary restraining order, setting a hearing for Friday of that week. This was America's first-ever order for prior restraint of the press. The last story rewritten from the Times ran in the Post on June 16th, my birthday, which I celebrated at dinner with Polly Wisner and Bob McNamara at Joe Alsop's. That day was also the last on which the Times was free to publish, and the day we received the papers, a tremendous day for the Post, and for me as well. Our editors and reporters had been trying desperately to get their hands on the papers. Ben Bagdikian, the national editor, had guessed that Daniel Ellsberg was the source for them at the Times, and he had been frantically calling Ellsberg. Finally, on the 16th, a friend of Ellsberg's phoned Bagdikian and asked him to call back from a payphone. Bagdikian spoke to Ellsberg, who said he would give him the papers that night. He then returned to the paper and consulted with Gene Patterson, Ben Bradley was away, asking for assurances that if we got the papers, we would start printing them on Friday morning. Gene said we would, but felt Bagdikian should check with Bradley, which Bagdikian did from the airport. Bradley's response, which may be apocryphal but certainly sounds like something Ben would say, was, "If we don't publish, there's going to be a new executive editor of the Washington Post." Bagdikian then departed for Boston with an empty suitcase, as per instructions. He returned to Washington the next morning with what has been described as a disorganized mass of photocopied sheets completely out of sequence and with very few page numbers. The suitcase he'd brought was too small for what he was given, so he loaded the papers into a big cardboard box and flew back to Washington on a first-class seat with the box occupying the seat beside him, an additional expense the Post didn't mind paying. Bagdikian went straight to Ben Bradley's house, rushing past, as Ben later reported, Marina Bradley, age 10, tending her lemonade stand outside. Ben Bradley had already gathered there several reporters, Chalmers Roberts, Murray Marder, and Don Oberdorfer among them, and two secretaries to help sort out the mess, as well as Phil Jalen and Meg Greenfield from the editorial page, and Howard Simons. Chal was 2 weeks short of retirement, but he and Murray knew the most about the story, and Chal was the fastest writer on the paper. They were joined at Ben's house by Roger Clark and Tony Essay, our principal lawyers, since Bill Rogers had left his firm to become Secretary of State. Sorting out the 4,400 pages that we had and deciding what to write was more than a day's chore in itself, and we were also working under the added pressure of knowing that the Times had been enjoined from further publication and that the Washington Post Company was about to go public, with all that that entailed. I was pleased that we had found the papers and had them in hand, but I spent the day of June 17th in a rather routine way. I had planned a large party to be held that afternoon at my house for Harry Gladstone, a lovely man who was leaving the Post. He had come to the paper as circulation director, but was vice president and business manager at the time. The whole business staff of the Post was gathered for the party, including Fritz, who had come down to Washington for it, but had gone over to Ben's house to check on things there. As it turned out, a fierce legal battle was being waged. What Ben experienced as he rushed back and forth between the rooms where the reporters were working and the living room where the lawyers were conferring was that the lawyers seemed to be pushing strongly for not publishing, or at least for waiting until there was a decision on the injunction against the Times. Our situation, however, was very different from that of the Times. The court order against them meant that, if we were to publish, our action might be viewed as defying the law and disrespecting the court. Even more difficult than that was the delicacy of our business position. In going public, a company negotiates with its underwriters, in this case a group led by Lazard Frères, and on the day of the offering, everyone agrees on a price and signs an agreement. Our agreement said that in a week the underwriters would buy all the stock from the company and then turn around and resell it to those they'd offered it to in the intervening week. There was a standard stipulation that if any one of a variety of crises, such as a war or national emergency, or, more to the point in our case, the companies being subjected to criminal action, were to intervene, the underwriter would be let out of the contract. We were exposing ourselves to just such a possibility if we published while the Times was enjoined. In addition, Fritz had written into the original prospectus a paragraph stating that we would publish a newspaper dedicated to the community and national welfare. He now worried that the underwriters could make a case, as indeed the administration was trying to do, that what we were doing was contrary to the national welfare. Fritz had an extraordinary sensitivity to editorial issues and to the editors themselves, both at the Post and at Newsweek. But in this case, as a lawyer, he had to worry about the future of the company. Furthermore, he worried that we could be in trouble under the Espionage Act. He thought the government would be most likely to prosecute the corporation or the company, and if the corporation acquired the status of a felon, we would be stripped of our licenses to own and operate our television stations, adding a huge financial issue to the already high stakes. So, while in one room at Ben's house, Chawl was banging out his story for publication the next day, Murray was slowly reading through the material, and Don Oberdorfer was working on installments on the late Johnson years. In another room, the lawyers, with Fritz and the editors, were locked in tough and tense arguments. Clark and Essay argued against publication and in favor of letting the Times handle the freedom of the press issue. Fritz seemed to be siding with the lawyers. Ben was beginning to feel squeezed between the editors and the reporters, who were solidly lined up for publishing and supporting the Times on the issue of freedom of the press, and the lawyers, who at one point suggested a compromise whereby the Post would not publish the papers on Friday, but would notify the Attorney General of its intention to publish on Sunday. Howard Simons, who was 100% for publishing, summoned the reporters to talk directly with the lawyers. Oberdorfer said the compromise was the shittiest idea I've ever heard. Roberts said the Post would be crawling on its belly to the Attorney General. If the Post didn't publish, he would move his retirement up 2 weeks, make it a resignation, and publicly accuse the Post of cowardice. Murray Marder recalled saying, "If the Post doesn't publish, it will be in much worse shape as an institution than if it does, since the paper's credibility would be destroyed journalistically for being gutless." Bagdikian reminded the lawyers of the commitment to Ellsberg to publish the papers and declared, "The only way to assert the right to publish is to publish." In the midst of the bedlam, Ben left the room to call his closest friend, Ed Williams, who by now was also a good friend of mine. Ed was in Chicago trying a divorce case, and Ben reached the editor of the Chicago Sun-Times and asked him to send a copy boy down to the court with a message saying he needed to talk to Ed immediately, conveying the idea that this was, as Ben later said, as serious as anything I've ever faced.
Ed was a great lawyer with a lot of political as well as common sense. The two men talked for perhaps 10 minutes, according to Ben, during which Ben, as objectively as he could, told Ed everything that had happened to that point, and then waited for a response. Ed finally said,
"Well, Benji, you've got to go with it."
Gene Patterson's job that day was to run the newsroom as though nothing were happening. But the people in the newsroom are as good at sniffing out something happening right in their midst as they are at following stories outside. No one could help noticing the absence of Chawl, Murray, and Don Oberdorfer, as well as Bagdikian, Howard, and Ben. Certainly something was up. Gene stopped by Ben's house on his way to my party, and then walked up the hill to my house. As I was receiving guests, he pulled me aside and gave me the first warning of what was to come, saying that he believed the decision on whether to print was going to be checked with me, and that he knew I fully recognized that the soul of the newspaper was at stake.
"God, do you think it's coming to that?" I asked.
Yes, Gene said he did. By now, crucial time was passing. The deadline for the second edition was fast approaching. Jim Daly had come up to me twice at Gladstein's party, worrying about when we'd get the story and be able to put it into print, and asking if I had yet heard from the other house. I was strangely unconcerned, and said I was sure they were just finishing and we would get it in time. It was a lovely June day, and the party for Harry spilled out of the house onto the terrace and the lawn. I was making a toast to him and going full blast about how much he had meant to the paper and to me personally, when someone tugged at my sleeve and said with some urgency, "You're wanted on the phone." I protested that I had to finish the toast, but the response was, "They want you now." I finally got the idea that it was really important, wound up the toast quickly, and took the call in a corner of the library. I was sitting on a small sofa near the open door, and Paul Ignatius stood near me. Fritz was on the other end of the line. He told me about the argument between the lawyers and the editors over whether to publish the next day, outlined the reasoning on both sides, and concluded by saying, "I'm afraid you are going to have to decide." I asked Fritz for his own view. Since he was so editorial-minded and so decent, I knew I could trust his response. I was astonished when he said,
"I guess I wouldn't."
I then asked for time to think it over, saying, "Can't we talk about this? Why do we have to make up our minds in such haste when the Times took 3 months to decide?" At this point, Ben and the editors got on various extensions at Ben's house. I asked them what the big rush was, suggesting we at least think about this for a day. "No," Ben said, "it was important to keep up the momentum of publication and not to let a day intervene after getting the story." He also stressed that by this time, the Grapevine knew we had the papers. Journalists inside and outside were watching us. I could tell from the passion of the editors' views that we were in for big trouble on the editorial floor if we didn't publish. I well remember Phil Jalen's response when I said that deciding to publish could destroy the paper.
"Yes," he agreed, "but there's more than one way to destroy a newspaper."
At the same time that the editors were saying, seriatim, "You've got to do it," Paul Ignatius was standing beside me, repeating, each time more insistently, "Wait a day, wait a day." I was extremely torn by Fritz's saying that he wouldn't publish. I knew him so well, and we had never differed on any important issue. And after all, he was the lawyer, not I. But I also heard how he said it. He didn't hammer at me, he didn't stress the issues related to going public, and he didn't say the obvious thing, that I would be risking the whole company on this decision. He simply said he guessed he wouldn't. I felt that, despite his stated opinion, he had somehow left the door open for me to decide on a different course. Frightened and tense, I took a big gulp and said, "Go ahead, go ahead, go ahead, let's go, let's publish," and I hung up. So the decision was made. But later that evening, Fritz came over to my house. Roger Clark, still worried, had thought of a new problem. He feared an extra charge of collusion with the Times and wanted to know the source of our obtaining the papers. Bagdikian by this time had gone to the paper, carrying the last of Charles' story, to set in type.
At first, Bagdikian maintained that the source was confidential, but when Clark insisted, he identified Ellsberg, the presumed source for the Times, which only increased Clark's concern about collusion. This time Fritz really helped. I had no idea whether collusion made our situation more vulnerable or not, but Fritz said that we'd made up our minds and should go ahead. I was relieved and agreed. Our lawyers by then were behind us and very supportive. In addition, Fritz had Roswell Gilpatrick of the Cravath firm down from New York, with whom he was informally consulting, as Ben was with Edward Bennett Williams. The two young lawyers in the Washington branch of our law firm, Royal Kergolin Wells, sent to New York for litigator William Glendon, whom we didn't know and who was relatively inexperienced with cases like this. At about 3 p.m. Friday, while I happened to be sitting in Ben's office, a call came from William Rehnquist, then the Assistant Attorney General for the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Counsel. Rehnquist read the same message to Ben that he had sent to the Times. Ben told Rehnquist, "I'm sure you will understand that I must respectfully decline." He also refused to delay the rest of the series pending resolution of the Times's case in New York. The government promptly filed suit against the Post, a suit that matched the one lodged against the Times and named as defendants everyone on the masthead of the paper, plus the author of the first article, the one that had appeared on June 18th, Chalmers Roberts. The case was routinely assigned to Judge Gerhard Gesell, a distinguished jurist of a liberal mind. He had helped in the 1954 acquisition of the Times-Herald at a time when he worked for Covington and Burling and had also been a friend of Phil's and mine when we were all young. But our paths had gone different ways, and I no longer saw him and his wife Peggy. In fact, Phil had fired him during one of his bad years, which was what enabled Jerry to take the case. At 8:05 p.m. on June 18th, Gesell ruled for the Post, refusing to grant an order restraining the paper from further publication of the series and saying, "The court has before it no precise information suggesting in what respects, if any, the publication of this information will injure the nation." The Court of Appeals, to which the government instantly went, ruled for the government at about 1:20 a.m., reversing Gesell's decision. Fritz was at the court with the lawyers, arguing that we had several thousand papers on the street and the plates on the presses. So, at 2:10 a.m., the court agreed with us that the injunction didn't apply to that night's paper, and we finished the press run. Jerry Gesell confided to me after his retirement, "If anybody ever carves anything on my tombstone, they might say I was the only judge out of 29 judges who heard the Pentagon Papers case, who never stopped the presses for a minute. The only one. I've always taken a little pride in that." In staying Gesell's order, the appeals court had also told him to hold a fuller, more detailed hearing on Monday, June 21st. Over the weekend, he'd tried to get a handle on what was behind the case, to get it into some kind of shape to be heard. Because the courthouse was undergoing construction, Gesell held a meeting at his house with some Justice Department officials, telling them to select the 10 most damaging things in the papers and that he would limit the Monday hearing to that list. At some point, a Justice Department lawyer told Gesell that, of course, the defendants, meaning all of us connected with the Post who'd been named in the suit, wouldn't be present at the hearing. It had to be held in secret. Gesell told him firmly, "We don't do things that way," adding, "If that's the way it's going to go, I'll dismiss the case. I won't even hold a hearing." He suggested the lawyer call the White House, or, as Gesell put it, wherever or whoever it was that gave you those instructions, and tell them he would dismiss the case if that was the condition. The lawyer did call someone and returned to say it would be all right to have the defendants present. Finally, the Justice Department lawyers left, leaving the papers behind. As Gesell later recounted, "They hadn't been gone but 2 or 3 minutes when there was a knock on the door, and here were two fellows all in uniform, great big white sashes or whatever it is across their uniform, and guns and all this, and said, 'We've come for the papers.' I said, 'I don't have to give you the papers. I want to read them.' Well, they said, 'You don't have any security out here. We can't let you have these papers.' I said, 'I've got the best security in the world. I put them under my sofa pillow, and you're not going to have them. You can stay here all night if you want to guard the place, but I'm going to have the papers.' They disappeared after that.
On Monday, Fritz, Ben, Don, and Mary Graham and I, among others, went into court for the hearing. There was a swarm of press people outside. All the windows of the courtroom were blacked out. At one point, as the case proceeded, the government put on the stand an ex-CIA man who had been working in the Pentagon, who testified how serious the situation was, and that publication of some of these papers would reveal certain war plans of the United States. Gesell didn't believe this man, and called for the general in charge of the war plans to be sent over to testify. He was duly brought in, the quintessential general, bedecked with medals, and as Gesell remembers it, after taking the oath to tell the truth, he stated,
"Judge, if anybody thinks these are our war plans, I sure hope they do, because these are entirely out of date."
The government then tried to hit another of its points on the list, claiming that there was a Canadian diplomat who had infiltrated Vietnam and was passing information to the Americans, which was a violation of Canadian treason laws. The government's point was that, if the information got out, this was a capital offense and the man would be executed. Here is where the skill of our reporters helped us. Not only did they write depositions, but they came up with citations proving that the alleged top-secret items had already been published. Chal Roberts promptly supplied several published books to our lawyers, in each of which the Canadian diplomat was mentioned by name, along with a description of what he was doing. So much for that argument. In the end, Gesell refused to grant the government an injunction against the Post, allowing the series to resume. Later that day, however, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia continued the temporary restraining order and ordered a hearing before the full 9-judge appellate court, which heard the case on June 22nd. I attended the proceedings that day also. The court affirmed Gesell's decision, upholding the Post's constitutional right to continue the series based on the papers. At the same time, however, the court continued the restraining order to allow for an appeal. The day the New York Times had published its first story, Irwin Griswold, Solicitor General of the United States, and his wife were in Florida, sunning themselves at a hotel pool and resting after he had made a speech to the Florida State Bar Association the night before. When he read the Times' story on the Pentagon Papers, he immediately turned to his wife and said, "Well, it looks as though I'm going to have a case in the Supreme Court one of these days." Much later, he told me that he assumed November would be the earliest conceivable moment the case would be brought to the court. When he got back from Florida, there was a note for him to call the Attorney General. Griswold, who had been a Johnson appointee but was still serving under Nixon, said that at meetings with Mitchell and other Justice Department officials, he consistently counseled against going ahead with the case. I said, "The trouble is you don't have any ground to stand on, but nobody except me ever had any thought of not going ahead." On Friday, June 25th, the Supreme Court granted the petitions for certiorari from both the Times and the Post. At the same time, since the Times, because of its separate route through the courts, was still prohibited from publishing and the Post was not, the court, at least until a final decision could be handed down, put both newspapers under equal restraints, marking the first time the Supreme Court had restricted publication of a newspaper article. What the court's decision to accept the cases meant for Griswold was that he had only 24 hours to prepare his brief, still not having seen the papers themselves. He began to focus on them at once, arranging to see 3 government people and asking each of them to tell him what problems might arise if the papers were published in full. Even after talking with these people, he realized he didn't have a very strong case. Griswold was back in his office early Saturday morning to finish preparing his brief. With no help in the Justice Department on Saturday, he and his secretary ran it off on the mimeograph machine. They then assembled the pages, stamped them top secret, and went off to court. Griswold had 2 extra copies of his brief, one for the Times' counsel and one for the Post's. He recalled being taken aback when the guard for the papers asked him what he intended doing with those copies, and when he was told, said, "Well, that's treason. That's giving them to the enemy." Griswold nearly had a set to with a security man, insisting it was his professional responsibility to furnish copies of the brief to the other side. So bizarre were the security and secrecy surrounding the case
that officials from the government had taken away our own brief, impounding it as top secret. On Saturday, June 26th, the two cases, that of the New York Times and that of the Post, met for the first time, in that they were being heard together at the Supreme Court. None of us fully understood the nuances of what was being acted out in court after court, national security, prior restraint, the right to know, until we actually got to the Supreme Court. I went to the court with Fritz and several others from the Post for this unusual special session. The government's case was argued by Griswold, and the newspaper's case was argued by Alexander Bickel for the Times and William Glendon for the Post. I was in the Post's newsroom around midday on Wednesday, June 30th, when we received word that the court would convene at 2:30. Everyone in the newsroom was deadly quiet, waiting for the news. Right on time, Chief Justice Warren Burger announced the decision. Simultaneously, Deputy National Editor Mary Lou Beattie heard the news on an open phone line to the Supreme Court, and Jean Patterson heard it in the wire room, then jumped on a desk and called out, "We win, and so does the New York Times!" The newspapers were free to publish. By a 6-3 vote, the Supreme Court ruled that the government had not met the heavy burden of showing justification for restraining further publication of the Pentagon Papers as endangering national security. At the Post, having regarded ourselves as doing the public's business, we were gratified by the results and felt that the principle of no prior restraint of the press had been vindicated. We were also proud of the Post and its people. In a memo to the staff, I said, "I know I speak for all of us when I say what a great moment this is for the Washington Post." Ben Bradley was equally proud. He told the staff, "The guts and energy and responsibility of everyone involved in this fight, and the sense that you all were involved, has impressed me more than anything in my life. You are beautiful." We had prevailed, but ours was an incomplete victory. Basically, we were challenging the right of the executive branch to prevent a newspaper from publishing material we believed should be available to the public. In court, we had challenged the government's contention that the material in the papers was too sensitive for the public eye. We had strongly argued the case against prior restraint, but we had in fact been restrained. We were disappointed that the court's decree was both limited and ambiguous. Though the decision was in favor of allowing the newspapers to publish, there was, as I later said, no ringing reaffirmation of First Amendment guarantees that all publishers yearned to hear. The Supreme Court's decision had caused enormous rejoicing in the press at large and at the Post and Times in particular, but hidden away in the details of the separate opinions were some views that were of great concern to us, having to do with possible criminal prosecution after the fact. It was clear to us that Attorney General Mitchell felt avenues of criminal prosecution remained open, and that the Department of Justice was continuing its investigation and would prosecute those who in any way violated federal criminal laws in connection with the papers. Aspects of this threat were made even clearer to me by two strange messages received over the fence. One came from Ken Clawson, then still a Post reporter. A few days after the Supreme Court decision was handed down, Clawson told me he had had a message from Richard Kleindienst, then Deputy Attorney General. At one point, we had independently, and in an effort to act responsibly, decided we wouldn't publish those items that had been specified in the Solicitor General's secret brief as being those most threatening to the national interest. We didn't even have some of the volumes of the papers that the government found most objectionable. Others we felt had no news value. Kleindienst, however, wanted me to know that it would not be enough to agree not to publish the portions of the papers that the government felt endangered national security. Rather, the Post would have to relinquish the parts of the papers it held relating to this kind of information. Clawson emphasized to me that Kleindienst had told him that the Post had been the subject of considerable talk at Justice. According to Clawson, Kleindienst had actually mentioned certain regulations barring ownership of radio and television properties after conviction for particular offenses. He also told Clawson that our stock prospectus would have to carry information relating to our being charged with a federal crime. It was a not very veiled threat that turning over the papers in our possession would go a long way toward avoiding criminal prosecution. Kleindienst has no memory of sending such a message. The second similar message came through Jean Patterson, who had been called by Joe Alsop. I'm not sure why Joe didn't tell me directly, but I think he genuinely believed that I was being misled by a bunch of wild men and was doing me a favor. Joe told Jean that he had spent some time with a high Justice Department official, Mr. X. He wanted to convey to the post Mr. X's feelings and those of the government. He talked about how grim the situation was, and said that the government was definitely considering proceeding criminally against the New York Times, the Post, and other papers. He concluded, referring to Nixon and many of those in his administration, "They hate the Post like poison. Knowing Nixon, I think he wants to tear out the guts of the Times, and yours too. I think there's an even chance he'll proceed." Recently, Henry Kissinger told me he felt that Nixon had always hated the Post. Henry said of Nixon, "He was convinced that the Post had it in for him. At what point he got that idea, I don't know, but when I met him, he already had that idea. He wanted a confrontation with the press. He really hated the press. As soon as there was an unfavorable article about him, he'd send notes around, prohibiting you from talking to the Post or to this or that reporter. Nobody ever fully honored it, because you couldn't do your business if you did. But he was antagonistic to the press. It was a big mistake." On Saturday morning, July 3rd, Ben and I met in my office with Edward Bennett Williams, not because he was a lawyer, but because we both trusted him, to discuss how, if at all, we should respond to what we had heard. We decided to respond indirectly through Bill Rogers, emphasizing to him that we didn't have in our possession the volumes that we understood contained the information Kleindienst was most concerned about. We also told him that when we published anything from any of the rest of the documents, we would not publish information based on intercepted communications, signal intelligence, and cryptography in general, adhering to this policy as we had in the past. In the end, no further overt action was taken, but we lived under the threat of repercussions and began to feel the pressure increase as the months wore on. In retrospect, it's hard to understand why Nixon and his people were so upset by the publication of these papers, which were essentially a history of decisions made before they were in power. Nothing in them was a reflection on Nixon. I believe the administration's reaction was an example of its extreme paranoia about national security and secrecy in general. Certainly their paranoia was evident early on. Griswold acknowledged as much in an op-ed article for the Post titled "Secrets Not Worth Keeping" that appeared in February of 1989 at the time of Iran-Contra, saying that there was a massive overclassification by the government and that the principal concern of the classifiers is not with national security, but rather with governmental embarrassment of one sort or another. There is very rarely any real risk to current national security from the publication of facts relating to transactions in the past, even the fairly recent past. This is the lesson of the Pentagon Papers experience. In fact, only a tiny portion of the contents of the papers was really secret material, and Daniel Ellsberg, the original provider of the papers, had withheld those portions from the beginning. At the end of 1971, I discussed the issues surrounding publication of the Pentagon Papers in a speech I gave at Denison University. I still maintain what I said then, which was essentially that we believed from the start that the material in the Pentagon Papers was just the kind of information the public needed in order to form its opinions and make its choices more wisely. In short, we believed the papers were so useful to a greater understanding of the way in which America became involved in the Vietnam War that we regarded their publication not as a breach of the national security, as the administration claimed, but rather as a contribution to the national interest, indeed as the obligation of a responsible newspaper. As I concluded in that speech 25 years ago, and as I strongly still believe, the sobering reality is that the process laid bare in the Pentagon Papers is precisely the process by which most of the business of government is carried forward. We may wholeheartedly embrace the pledge of no more Vietnams, but until we open up the system and expose its workings to the light of public scrutiny, that pledge will remain in the realm of empty rhetoric. Needless to say, the minor irritations experienced between the Post and the Nixon administration prior to this, which had slowly ratcheted up the tension in the overall atmosphere, had now turned major. The Pentagon Papers case took the continual day-to-day sparring between government and the press onto a new level. Rulers and reporters may be natural antagonists, as I said at the time, but the Nixon administration now entered the ring with a particularly deliberate gusto. By sending the Justice Department into court, instead of merely using the vice president as a mouthpiece, they had changed the character of the fight. We all began to worry more and more about freedom of the press and about the Nixon administration's imperious attitude that the authority to determine what the American people should know rests exclusively with the government. We also felt, as Ben later said, that if the press was the target, the victim is the public. The Pentagon Papers may or may not have been the compelling case we all thought it was, but it set in motion certain trends. Although the case came and went, unbelievably, in only 2.5 weeks, its ripple effect was great, and publishing the papers went a long way toward advancing the interests of the Post. As Ben later said, that was a key moment in the life of this paper. It was just sort of the graduation of the Post into the highest ranks. One of our unspoken goals was to get the world to refer to the Post and New York Times in the same breath, which they previously hadn't done. After the Pentagon Papers, they did. From my point of view, the Post and I had been hurled onto the national scene almost unwittingly. For the first time in my professional life, we became major players. Eyes were on us. What we did mattered to the press and to the country. To some degree, I gained a measure of self-assurance. This was my first serious visibility on the national scene. I was very publicly exposed, written about, photographed, and interviewed, which both seared me and, to some extent, fed my ego. The pressure, the intensity, and the rapidly unfolding developments were another extraordinary learning experience for me. The whole affair also bound many of us at the Post even more closely together, especially Ben, Howard Simons, Phil Jalen, Meg Greenfield, and me. The editors had been wonderful. From the late 1960s, these people had worked so well together, having a great deal of fun at the same time. There was trust and affection among them, as well as between them and me. Our group was one of the great strengths that kept me going and lightened my life. I gained even more confidence in Ben. He and I had already created a true understanding between us, as well as a respect and admiration for each other. But until the Pentagon Papers, we had never been tested publicly in any way. Ben later said that not publishing the papers could have been a real disaster for the Post, with many people quitting the paper. He reflected that he himself probably wouldn't have quit, but I would have been beaten, and the goals, the aspirations that we were just beginning to see would have been lost. What Ben and I told each other at the time says a lot about the point to which our relationship had evolved and how much we depended on and appreciated each other. Ben had started a tradition of writing me a letter at Christmas time in lieu of flowers. I always responded in kind, but I wrote him now in the middle of the year, on the very day the Supreme Court announced its decision. We always write each other love letters at Christmas, but the paper over the last 2+ weeks is better than Christmas, and it's earlier, too. There never was such a show. It was incredible. And it was only possible because of that extra 10% of the 110% that you and those under you put into it. It was beautiful and fun, too, and it was a trip, a pleasure to do business with you as ever. Ben wrote me right back, "Doing business with you is so much more than a pleasure. It's a cause, it's an honor, and such a rewarding challenge. I'm not sure I could handle another one of these tomorrow, but it is so great to know that this whole newspaper will handle the next one with courage and commitment and style." Indeed, publishing the Pentagon Papers made future decisions easier, even possible. Most of all, it prepared us, and I suspect, unfortunately, Nixon as well, for Watergate. Chapter 23. On Saturday morning, June 17, 1972, Howard Simons called to say, "You won't believe what happened last night." He was right. I barely believed him and listened with equal amounts of amusement and interest as he told me of a car that crashed into a house where two people had been making love on a sofa and went right out the other side. To top that, he related the fantastic story that five men wearing surgical gloves had been caught breaking into the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee. President Nixon was in Key Biscayne, Florida, at the time. His press secretary, Ron Ziegler, dismissed the incident as a third-rate burglary attempt, adding, "Certain elements may try to stretch this beyond what it is." None of us, of course, had any idea how far the story would stretch. The beginning, once the laughter died down, all seemed so farcical. It was Joe Califano, who was then not only our lawyer, but also a lawyer for the Democratic National Committee, who had called Howard in the first place. Howard swung into action. Once he'd spoken to me, and tried to reach Ben, who was at his cabin in West Virginia, with a phone that didn't work, he phoned Harry Rosenfeld, then the Metropolitan editor, who in turn called Barry Sussman, the one of his three deputies who focused on the District of Columbia. Al Lewis, the Post's police reporter since 1935, who knew everyone in the whole department, was dispatched to begin to cover the story. As usual, he headed first to the police station to get the names of those arrested, all fictitious, as it turned out. There, he serendipitously bumped into the acting chief of police, Charlie Wright, with whom he was very friendly. The two of them went off together to the Watergate, where Al just walked right in with Wright. What he saw was a hive of activity, with people from the mobile crime lab trying to get fingerprints off the front door and others removing tiles from the ceiling to look for wiretaps. Lewis took off his jacket and stayed all day. The story of the break-in appeared on the front page of Sunday's paper, "Five held in plot to bug Democrats' office here," with Lewis's byline. Contributing to the story were several staff writers, including Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, who also did a separate report with background information on the suspects, four of whom, Carl discovered, were from Miami, where they had been involved in anti-Castro activities. Phil Jalen's editorial appearing the next day in the Post was titled "Mission Incredible" and began with a quote from the CBS television show Mission Impossible: "As always, should you or any of your force be caught or killed, the Secretary will disavow any knowledge of your actions." What we were seeing, of course, was the legendary tip of the iceberg, and we might never have known the size of the iceberg had it not been for the extraordinary investigative and reporting efforts of Woodward and Bernstein, famous names now, but then two young men who had never worked together, one of whom, Woodward, had not even been long at the paper. In some ways, it was a natural pairing, since their qualities and skills complemented each other. Both are bright, but Woodward was conscientious, hard-working, and driven, and Bernstein messy and undisciplined. He was, however, the better writer, more imaginative and creative. In other ways, the relationship was oil and water, but the end product came out right, despite, or perhaps because of, the strange mix. Barry Sussman, with only a few details about the botched burglary, knew that he wanted Bob Woodward on the story. Woodward had come to us fresh from the Navy. Having been accepted by Harvard Law School, he had chosen instead to pursue journalism as a career. He so much wanted to work for the Post that Harry Rosenfeld had told his deputy, Andy Barnes, to put Woodward on for 2 weeks, without pay, and to look at his copy every night to see what he could do. Not one of the 17 stories Bob wrote during those 2 weeks was printed, and at the end of the trial period, Barnes confidently declared that Woodward was a bright and good guy, but lacked the skills needed for being a newspaper man. In short, was hopeless, and would be too much trouble to train. Harry told Woodward to get some experience and come back in a year. To Woodward, this was a kick in the stomach, but also an inspiration, and he didn't interpret Harry's parting words as a total rejection. It may have been wishful thinking on Bob's part, since for him the point was that, in failing for 2 weeks at journalism, I knew I loved it. So Bob went off and got a job on the nearby Montgomery County Sentinel in Maryland, where it wasn't long before he began scooping the Post's metro reporters. After some months, he started phoning Harry again. One day he called him at home, interrupting his vacation and finding him on a ladder painting his basement. Having already been interrupted more times than he felt warranted for a man on vacation, Harry was in a foul temper and complained to his wife Anne about this young upstart calling him up all the time and pestering him. Anne quietly asked, "Isn't that what you always say is the kind of person you want, Harry?" She was, of course, exactly right, and Harry finally decided to hire Woodward, who started at the post right after Labor Day in September 1971, the day, as Bob later told me, unbeknownst to all of us, that Howard Hunt and Gordon Liddy got on the airplane to go to Los Angeles to break into Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist's house. From the beginning, Bob distinguished himself, and there was no question in the editors' minds whom they were going to send to court to cover the break-in. Carl Bernstein, on the other hand, had been at the post since the fall of 1966, but had not distinguished himself. He was a good writer, but his poor work habits were well known throughout the city room even then, as was his famous roving eye. In fact, one thing that stood in the way of Carl's being put on the story was that Ben Bradley was about to fire him. Carl was notorious for an irresponsible expense account and numerous other delinquencies, including having rented a car and abandoned it in a parking lot, presenting the company with an enormous bill. But Carl, looking over Bob's shoulder while he reworked Al Lewis's notes, immediately got hooked on this strange story and was off and running. It was Harry who saved him when both Ben and Howard wanted to fire him, saying that he was pursuing the Watergate story with verve, working hard, and contributing a great deal. And it was Carl who made the first connection of the crisp new $100 bills in the pockets of the burglars to money raised for the Nixon campaign. Woodward and Bernstein clearly were the key reporters on the story, so much so that we began to refer to them collectively as Woodstein. But the cast of characters at the Post who contributed to the story from its inception was considerable. As executive editor, Ben was the classic leader at whose desk the buck of responsibility stopped. He set the ground rules, pushing, 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 not so subtly asking everyone to take one more step, relentlessly pursuing the story in the face of persistent accusations against us and a concerted campaign of intimidation. Howard Simons, with his semi-independent pocket of authority on the paper, helped move the story along enormously, particularly with his attitude, as Woodward later described it, of inquisitiveness and let's find out what's going on. Harry Rosenfeld said of Howard, "When the kids were running one way or the other, he would, if it was called for, stand up and screw the tide." It was Howard who carried the story in its early days. Harry himself was an old-style, tough, picturesque editor and another real hero of Watergate for us. From the outset, he thought of the story as a very big local one, seeing it as something on which the Post's local staff could distinguish itself. He controlled the story before it regularly made page one of the paper, keeping it going on the front page of the Metro section. Barry Sussman eventually was released from his duties as District of Columbia editor to devote full time to directing the day-to-day Watergate coverage. He was just the person for the job. As described by Woodward and Bernstein in All the President's Men, Sussman had the ability to seize facts and lock them in his memory, where they remained poised for instant recall. More than any other editor at the Post, Sussman became a walking compendium of Watergate knowledge, a reference source to be summoned when even the library failed. Watergate was a puzzle, and he was a collector of the pieces. On the editorial side, Phil Jalin and Meg Greenfield were invaluable. Through their editorials, along with those by Roger Wilkins, they plugged away at the import of what was unfolding on our news pages. The Post's editorials consistently argued the seriousness of the known facts in the first several months, well before the White House had even acknowledged special concern, and at a time when the whole matter was thought to be dead. These editorials played a great part in keeping the issues before the public and had a demonstrable impact on the way people came to think about Watergate. An even more immediate impact was achieved by Herblock. From the cartoon that appeared a few days after the third-rate burglary, depicting a guard throwing one of the burglars out of the Democratic National Headquarters with Richard Nixon, Richard Kleindienst, and John Mitchell looking on, over the caption, Who would think of doing such a thing? To his justly famous one, of Nixon trying to hang on to the ends of two reels of tape on which the words, "I am a crook," appear, with a clipped piece of tape with the word "not" on it in his mouth, Herblock kept up his relentless assault. He was well ahead of me and of the news side of the paper. 6 days after the burglary, I was in the newsroom when he shared with me a cartoon he'd drawn showing two men investigating footsteps representing the bugging case and the Nixon fund scandals, footsteps that led right to the front door of the White House. The caption read, "Strange, they all seem to have some connection with this place." I laughed and said, "You're not going to print that, are you?" It appeared the next